Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 8th of August, these are our main stories. UN climate experts say meat and dairy production are fueling global warming, and the world must change its diet. Dramatic developments in Kyrgyzstan as the former president calls on supporters to defend his residence from security forces. And
they force me to wear niqab and hijab.
If I want to play and they take it off, they beat me.
The Saudi sisters who are hiding in Turkey after escaping from their family. Also in this podcast,
our policy is clear, and that is liberating our country. Our policy is not killing our own people.
A Taliban spokesman says agreement with the US over peace in Afghanistan is very close. How a woman MP in Kenya caused outrage by taking her baby into Parliament. And the bare facts about nudism in Germany and why it's on the decline. UN scientists have warned the world must look after the land to help tackle climate change, and that rising temperatures are putting food supplies at risk. This is a major report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. It says it believes ever-increasing consumption of meat and dairy products is causing soils to release carbon previously trapped underground, leading to further heating of the atmosphere. Valerie Masson-Delmotte is the co-chair of one of the IPCC working groups.
We humans affect more than 70% of ice-free land. A quarter of this land is degraded. The way we produce food and what we eat contributes to the loss of natural ecosystems and declining biodiversity. When land is degraded, it reduces the soil's ability to take up carbon, and this exacerbates climate change.
The scientists highlighted the fact that plant-based diets had a lower carbon footprint than other types of diet. I spoke to our environment analyst Roger Harabin, who's in Geneva, and asked him whether the UN scientists are really telling us all to become vegetarians.
I think if you talk to them privately, a lot of them would say absolutely the world should move towards vegetarianism and veganism. They cannot say that officially. This is a major governmental report, intergovernmental report, involving all the nations of the world and advisers from the world of science. And together they have to thrash out a compromise document which doesn't offend anyone. If it offends anybody, then they stay up for even more of the long night sessions that they've had throughout this past week. So the document is a compromise. Reading between the lines in it, it is quite clear that we can make major inroads into emissions from agriculture if we eat less red meat, not necessarily vegan or vegetarian, but just cutting portion sizes or maybe eating red meat less often. It also makes many points about large-scale agriculture and forestry, about the way they are damaging the soil and releasing CO2 into the atmosphere.
And Roger, what's their analysis of what will happen if things continue as they are at the moment, unchecked?
They made that clear last year in the assessment report, which looked at whether or not we could hold global temperature rise to 1.5 Celsius. They're warning that at the moment, that the way things are going, a global temperature will rise 3, perhaps more degrees. And they're pinpointing land use this time as one of the things that's been neglected in terms of how we can cut greenhouse gas emissions. So one thing that the previous speaker didn't say was that around a quarter of all our emissions that are heating the planet are coming from the way we use the land. Three quarters are still coming from our cars and factories and energy systems and what have you, but a quarter is coming from the land. And the scientists here are making the point that really, if we don't solve the problem with how we're treating the land, we won't solve climate change. The report doesn't state in so many words, but that is clearly what the scientists mean.
Our environment analyst Roger Harabin with me from Geneva. Now, as we record this podcast, there are reports from the Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan that a second raid is underway to try to arrest the former president, Almazbek Atambayev. Special forces first stormed his residence on the outskirts of the capital on Wednesday. Gulnara Kasmanbet, the editor of BBC Kyrgyz, told me more.
Everything is happening in such a fast pace, as if you're watching some dynamic detective story, really. It's a movie unfolding in front of our eyes. Atambayev's supporters were about to start their rally in Bishkek, and suddenly one of them shouting, "We are going back to Atambayev's compounds because a second raid being prepared there now." And then people immediately moved. We quickly checked and realized that the road was already blocked by the police because our correspondent wants to arrive first and see what's happening there, but he couldn't go through. So we assumed now that his supporters will try to go either on horses through the mountains or via cars, possibly, you know, half an hour, 1 hour, driving around to come back to the compound.
And this sounds like a potentially explosive situation.
It is, potentially. This is very volatile because Kyrgyzstan is a very small country sandwiched between Russia and China and surrounding Central Asian countries. And they don't need tens of thousands of protesters to shake the whole country. It is stories like this where locally something emerges and explodes. Why it is so volatile? We've already got a case yesterday when normal civilians, supporters of President Atambayev, ex-president, maybe members of his Social Democracy Party, and they were just normal civilians. And the police forces, they are civilians too. And suddenly we saw their clash yesterday, resulting in 48 people wounded. One officer has died already, leaving behind his four children. And all of these are Kyrgyz people, Kyrgyz citizens. That's why it is volatile, because it is happening amongst themselves. And we don't know which platform it will take. Is it going to be a party against party, or is it going to be something against the current president because somebody used, even if they used bullets made of plastic, still they shot at them. And that creates a resentment amongst people.
Gulnara Kasmanbet from BBC Kyrgyz. The Russian government says there's been an explosion at a naval testing facility in the far north. As we came into the studio, it was confirmed that two civilian specialists had been killed. An official said the city had recorded a short-term increase in radiation after the blast, but the Russian Defence Ministry said radiation levels were normal. Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
Russia's defense ministry says the explosion happened as a jet engine was being tested at a naval facility near Arkhangel. Two specialists were killed in the blasts and the fire that followed. The six injured include military personnel. It's thought the facility involved test missiles for Russia's northern fleet, including its nuclear submarines, which are based nearby. Some reports suggest there was a spike in radiation levels locally after the explosion, but the defense ministry insists there were no dangerous emissions. The regional governor says evacuating people from the area isn't necessary.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. It's almost 2 months since Dua and Dalal, two sisters from Saudi Arabia, escaped from their father while on a trip to Istanbul, fleeing their country and their family. They are the latest in a string of Saudi women who fled their highly conservative homeland. They're now in hiding in Turkey's biggest city, hoping to claim asylum in a third country. Our Turkey correspondent Mark Lowen went to meet them.
It's a cramped apartment in Istanbul. The kitchen is sparse. But for Saudi sisters Dua and Dalal al-Shuweiki, it's still freedom. They've lost count of how many times they've moved since June, shifting every few days as they hide from the life they escaped. Dalal, 20, and Dua, 22, fled while their family was on holiday here 2 months ago, running from a life of Saudi conservatism and violence, now hoping for asylum elsewhere. Incognito in Istanbul, Dua tells me of the childhood they left behind, girls covered from a young age.
Since I was kid, like 10, they forced me to wear niqab and hijab. And they was beating us for reason or no reason. My father and my mother.
If I want to play and then take it off, they beat me.
The sisters now sit in jeans and T-shirts. Dua with short hair, lesbian, from one of the world's most homophobic countries.
When did you take the decision that you were going to flee?
After they kicked me out from the university.
Why did they kick you out from university?
Because I'm gay. And I was have a girlfriend and they know about her.
Did your parents know you're gay?
Yes, they know. They think if I married to men, I will change my sexuality. So they always put pressure on me, like, to get married, but I always refuse. And they beat me. Sometimes my mother gets angry and she take all my clothes and throw it to the garbage. My father told me, I have someone he wants to marry you, and he is my friend, and he have two wives and children, and he is old. I was shocked. Like, I told him, like, I don't want to marry two old men and have two wives. He told me it's okay, he have money. Girls just care about money and children. They don't care about anything else.
A week after arriving in Istanbul in June with their father, his second wife and their grandmother, the sisters grabbed their passports from his bag. He realised and took them back, suspicious. Then at night, they seized their chance and ran, not knowing where to.
I was so excited.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, like, I will go to the airport and I get so afraid. But when I think, like, I will live my life and
because
I get
also,
so excited.
It was my first time without the abaya, first.
Yeah.
Second, like, I was so scared. Like, all the thing that I'm thinking about, like, my father gonna kill me.
We reached the girl's father by phone. He called his daughter's claims completely false, denying he had ever hit or forced them into marriage. He accepted Dua's sexuality, he said, adding that he was open-minded and still loved them wherever they end up. Two young women taking the biggest risk of their lives for life itself. And so in Istanbul they wait, a British lawyer working with them to get them asylum.
I just want to feel safe. Any country will accept us, we will go, of course.
Dua Andalal speaking in Istanbul to our correspondent Mark Lowen. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
It's all very well carrying out a raid like this, but if you've got bribery and corruption top to bottom, you're not going to solve it.
Why police in Johannesburg are being criticised just a day after a major operation was hailed as a huge success. A Taliban spokesman has told BBC News it's very close to an agreement with the United States. Sahel Shaheen, a spokesperson for the Taliban's political office in Qatar, has been speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. And Lise asked him how the Taliban can tout its peace talks while still killing people in Afghanistan every day.
We are committed to bring about a sustainable peace. But right now, we have not concluded the peace deal. How can it be possible? We have
the Taliban take responsibility for some of the attacks which have killed civilians.
No.
You call them spoilers. Do you mean there are some, the Taliban movement is divided?
No. Never we have taken responsibility for civilians because that is not our policy. Our policy is clear, liberating our country. Our policy is not killing our
killing
our own people. That's not our policy. Collateral damage, we are investigating that.
It's
this
very
department
hard to call it collateral damage when so many civilians are being killed.
But
civilians are being targeted. Schools are being hit.
Yeah, that's from the the Kabul administration by the Americans.
Well, let's take the most recent. The Taliban have called on Afghans to stay away from election rallies because they have said their fighters will be targeting election rallies. You know, the civilians will be at those rallies. So, how can you talk peace here and then say that you are going to attack the institutions which are an important part of the Afghanistan you say you want to join?
No. We requested the people to boycott the election.
But you've said you will target the election rallies. It's an important part of the Afghan democracy.
Not targeting, killing the people and requesting the people, as we did this in our last time. So that's a policy to boycott, because in our view, election under occupation is not a real election. It is only a farce.
So by this time, in 1-2 weeks' time, you should be sitting down and talking to Afghans?
I hope so.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, with the Taliban spokesperson, Sohail Shaheen. In Kenya, there's been controversy after a female MP was escorted out of Parliament after she attended the Wednesday morning session with her five-month-old baby. Rhoda Odhiambo has been following the story.
Order, members. Order, 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 order now. Order. With the House being called to order, a Kenyan woman MP, Zuleika Hassan, walked into the chambers with a five-month-old baby. Her colleagues attacked her verbally.
The Honourable Zuleika, you are out of order.
According to Parliament's standing orders, anyone who's not an MP, senator or women rep is a stranger in the precincts of Parliament. The MP wasn't given a chance to explain herself. What she saw were men surrounding her, asking her to leave. One of them was Majority Leader of the House, Aden Duale.
Mr. Speaker, this is an abuse of the House, and that member must be cited for gross misconduct. Mr. Speaker, this is an abuse, and that member must be cited, and she has ashamed the people of Kwale.
After she was ejected from Parliament, I found Zuleika playing with her child at her home. She said she was at a catch-22 situation and couldn't leave her baby unattended to.
I have two helpers to help me with the kids. So sometimes it happens where, you know, you need to send people here and there. And so there was an option of me to stay with the child at home this morning or go to work. So I could have chosen to just maybe stay back. But then why should I? You know, why should I miss work? So I just decided to just go to for the morning session with the baby to Parliament. And since there isn't a nursery, well, I had to go with her into the chamber because where else would I keep her?
We asked some Nairobians what they thought about the incident.
Parliament was right to ask that mama to go back home. Reason is every organization has got its own rules. Parliament has got also its own regulations, rules, so that whatever one does should not go beyond or against.
I think that every child deserves their time with their mom because you don't have two options or two chances to raise your kid. So if you don't have an option, then your work should accommodate you.
The MP said that she was shocked by the action of her male colleagues, some of who were part of the team that passed a bill that was later assented to by the president, compelling employers to construct special rooms where lactating mothers can breastfeed and change their babies. The irony here is that Parliament doesn't have such a facility.
The Parliamentary Service Commission passed in 2013 that we should, members of Parliament and staff, that we should get a room where it's a nursery, creche, you know, where we can leave our infants and still go to work and be able to, you know, to go to them if we needed to. So it's now 6 years, it hasn't been implemented. And it's not like we're looking for a new building and it's just a room.
Unfortunately, only a handful of companies in the country have fully-fledged lactating rooms, and with Parliament having none is a clear indication that the country has a long way to go in ensuring that nursing mums don't feel out of place at their workplace. Zuleika, together with other MPs, intend to push the country's Parliamentary Service Commission to put up a special room in Parliament to set an example to other companies in the country.
Rhoda Odhiambo reporting. What a difference a day makes for police in Johannesburg. On Wednesday, armed officers raided the city's central business district, arresting hundreds of undocumented foreign nationals and confiscating tons of counterfeit goods and unlicensed firearms. There was much praise for the way they handled themselves. Today, things don't look so rosy. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told me why.
Well, the police have made a fairly interesting, if not astonishing, admission that seven officers were arrested during the raid. Now, they're saying that five police officers were trying to sell some of these counterfeit goods back to the illegal traders, and they're going to face charges of corruption and defeating the ends of justice. And two members of what's called the Tactical Response Team tried to leak information about the planned operation to the people living there or operating those shops in downtown Johannesburg. And there's been an interesting reaction with some people saying things like many more where those seven came from and bet my top dollar they're out already. So quite a lot of scepticism in South Africa about the arrest of these seven police officers.
Quite a lot of humour and banter on social media about this story, but actually it underpins something more serious.
Yes, and there obviously are people who feel that it's all very well going after the people selling these counterfeit goods. But as one person on Twitter, Kay Sechwale, pointed out, she says, how many checkpoints do these counterfeit goods pass through before they reach a store belonging to an illegal immigrant? How many bribes are paid? She says the real problem doesn't lie in downtown Johannesburg. In other words, she's saying there is deep-rooted corruption that means that these counterfeit goods there, and it's all very well carrying out a raid like this, but if you've got bribery and corruption top to bottom, you're not going to solve it.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. In New Zealand, legislation to make it easier for women to have abortions has overwhelmingly passed its first vote in Parliament. The country's laws on abortion and contraception are 42 years old. The biggest change being proposed is removing a stipulation for two doctors to approve every abortion on physical or mental health grounds. Paul Henley's been finding out more from Andrew Little, New Zealand's Justice Minister.
This is a law that's been around a long time. It was put together at a time when there weren't very many women's voices in Parliament. One of the main problems with it is that it treats abortion in the first instance as a crime, and women effectively have a defence against the crime of killing an unborn child if they comply with the requirements in our Crimes Act and in another piece of legislation, the Contraception, Sterilisation and Abortion Act. That stigmatises women, so that changes. We remove all the barriers, and actually then we get to the point where the women in New Zealand get access to abortion at an earlier stage in their pregnancy than they do on average at the moment, and that'll be safer for women.
After 20 weeks of pregnancy, a woman seeking an abortion would require permission from a doctor. Is there an upper cut-off point where no abortion will be permitted? That is what pro-life groups are calling for.
We don't have that in our current law. We do have there's a test to apply, and we have a gestational threshold at 20 weeks. But we do have a very small number of abortions that do happen after 20 weeks, and that tends to be because the woman's life is threatened or the fetus is compromised, you know, very, very heavily compromised. So we will still have a 20-week gestational threshold. The test will be that the person carrying out the abortion has to be satisfied that it is appropriate and in the interests of the woman's physical or mental health or well-being.
And in cases under 20 weeks, what do you say to those campaign groups, religious and otherwise, who say that what you're organising is abortion on demand?
Well, this is about women being able to make that choice. It empowers women. At the moment, as you said in your introduction, women have to get two certifying consultants to approve the abortion. This enables women to make that choice. The reality is, we have roughly 13,200 abortions a year in New Zealand. Most of them, 90%, take place in the first trimester, and then it's sort of a smaller number right up to 20 weeks. This is about women being able to make choices about their body, their reproductive choices, which is the right thing to do.
I know New Zealand has a woman prime minister. Do you feel uncomfortable sometimes legislating on laws like this? It's a common criticism all over the world that it's men controlling women's reproductive rights.
Our current abortion law framework sits as a responsibility with the Minister of Justice. I happen to be the Minister of Justice. I've negotiated with other MPs, particularly one of our coalition partners, the New Zealand First Party, and with one of their senior women ministers. I've negotiated with senior women MPs from our Green Party. I've negotiated with women from our opposition party, the National Party. So there's a broad degree of consensus in terms of those I've consulted with to put this bill before the House. We have a very high proportion of women represented in our parliament. I think that's reflected in the vote. But actually what it reflects more than anything is that public opinion in New Zealand, I think, has moved on from what it was 40 years ago when the last abortion laws were put in place.
Andrew Little, the Justice Minister of New Zealand, with Paul Henley. Finally, Germany is losing its place at the top of the league for nudism. Surveys suggest it's been overtaken by Austria in terms of nudist per capita. Membership of Germany's National Organisation for Nudism is falling by about 2% a year. Our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders has been finding out the bare facts.
Freikörperkultur, literally free body culture, has been part of the fabric, or lack of it, of German society for donkey's years. Back in the year 1300, there were around 15 public baths in the city of Lübeck, where people stripped off without compunction. The fashion waned over time, but there was a resurgence at the end of the 19th century, mainly in response to the grimy excesses of the Industrial Revolution. Taking off clothing was a way of getting back to nature. The first nudist society in Germany was founded in Essen in 1898, as much a political as a social act, which is probably why the Nazis initially banned nudism. They later relented, seeing the propaganda value of the blonde stereotype showcased by the filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl. In the former East Germany, nudism was a welcome relief from overbearing state intrusion into daily life. But now there's the mobile phone and body image. Seasoned nudists say it's putting off the young people who've historically been the greatest enthusiasts. After all, who wants to risk being captured for posterity with a less than perfect posterior?
Mike Sanders reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Music life.
Music life.
Music life.
Music life.
It's about how you love music.
Is anyone listening to what I'm making?
Wow, that's so cool.
Oh, that sounds sick.
It's a really beautiful song.
You can't see me, but I'm really excited.
Speaking to musicians from across the globe.
We're in private jets and five-star hotels and all the rock star trimmings.
You're both on the same album of mine, but you've never met.
That's so cool.
About how they make their music.
Yo, this is a banger, man.
I know, I need to just give some extra energy.
Finding out all about their creative processes.
When you change things, you surprise people.
Oh, okay. You like this?
We're not annoying anyway. Yeah.
And getting to the bottom of why they do what they do.
When someone comes up to you and tells you how your song helped them through a time, for me, that's the most satisfying thing.
Music Life, a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Hear the teaser now by searching for Music Life wherever you found this podcast.